time as a faculty member after that, and unfortunately then he's recently moved to become a professor at Stanford University just earlier this year. His work has been recognized through many prizes, including the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. Today has really been a pioneer over the last 10 years or so in working in the field of quantum control. So I guess if you go back to sort of the 80s and 90s, a bunch of theorists started to ask the question, what happens if you take quantum mechanics really seriously? What does this imply about our the fundamental limits and our ability to control systems and to estimate parameters associated with those systems? And Hideo, I think, was really the first experimentalist to start taking these kinds of ideas very seriously. And nowadays, it's not so uncommon. You can certainly meet many people around the world. It's quantum control is sort of a thriving industry. But Hideo, I think, was sort of a voice in the wilderness in the early time, basically sort of explaining these ideas to the rest of the world and showing just how important it is. And it's done some really fantastic things. So, okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. It's great to be here. I think this is a fairly different type of audience than I normally speak to. And when considering what I ought to discuss in this kind of a colloquium setting, I decided to talk about some things, many of which are a few years old by now, but I thought it would be the most appropriate topic to bring up, because I think it does relate to some things that are being discussed by other people this week, Rob's talk earlier in the week, and actually the talk that comes up later on this afternoon. It might not be completely obvious, but I think the kinds of experiments that we're doing here hopefully have some relation to things like reference frames and quantum information theory and stuff like that. So I want to try to make that tie a little bit towards the very end of the talk, and hopefully I'll leave myself enough time to do that. Before I actually jump in, I wanted to acknowledge some people who have really done the work on this stuff. So there's an experiment here, which generally has been the joint work of one or two people at a time. Currently, that work is being done by Anthony Miller, who's a senior graduate student in our group. He has some help from a guy named Orion Crisafulli and also from another guy named Mike Armin. Prior to Anthony taking over, the experiment was really driven by Don Stockton, who has since graduated and become a postdoc with actually a different group at Stanford. Magnus Xu came to visit us over the last summer just as a kind of visiting graduate student from Australian National University. And then these guys down here actually are mainly working on some related theoretical stuff that I'll discuss a little bit along the way. Gopal Sarma is a graduate student, Luke Bowden and Andrew Silberfarb are postdocs in our group. And so all of this work that I'll talk about today has been done at Caltech. The experiment's actually still located at Caltech. But the group is in the process of moving up to Stanford, where we'll be in the Department of Applied Physics and the Ginston Laboratory. So the support for the work over the years has come from a combination of sources, the National Science Foundation, the Office of Naval Research, and the Army Research Office. And maybe what should be clear from that kind of a funding portfolio, I mean, I think there are really interesting fundamental things about the work that we're doing, but what's exciting is that we can tie it in not too ridiculous a way to fairly near-term technological applications, and that's one of the things that I'll kind of also be trying to emphasize as I discuss our results. So these days I always like to start off with this slide, which I call my quantum technology-ology slide. It tries to sort of show where the topic of today's talk, which is quantum metrology, or maybe quantum precision measurement, how that's related to related things that are going on in quantum computation and quantum cryptography. So I would say that if you kind of look underneath and ask what are the enabling disciplines that really give rise to exciting applications, you have on the one hand quantum information theory, which people here know quite a lot about, and then I would also say there's the kind of sister discipline of quantum filtering and control. And the difference there, I would say, is that here one has a lot more interest in real-time dynamics, delays, differential equations, things like that. And so just as in classical engineering, you have classical information theory, you have classical filtering and control theory, and then you draw from these things to get tools and methods that you need, these can give rise to sort of technology or technological applications, on the one hand in computing and cryptography, where I think most of the attention is these days. But you could draw techniques and methods from these same two areas and sort of go in a different direction, and that would lead you to the topic of quantum metrology, which is where our interest really is. And so here, just to define this a little bit, what I mean by that is the notion that if you ask about precision measurement tasks like sensing gravitational fields or sensing weak magnetic fields is what I'll talk about, or making accelerometers that you can use for things like inertial navigation, well, or making clocks, indeed. In any of those settings, quantum mechanics gives you funny noise sources that you have to deal with. And so you might ask, how do you deal with quantum noise sources in the context of precision measurement and metrology? But also, quantum mechanics sometimes gives you interesting sorts of resources, and you might ask, how can we best make use of those resources in order to measure those kinds of things that we want? And so that set of questions somehow gives rise to this field of quantum metrology, which I think is very interesting because it definitely has a similarity to computing and cryptography and stuff that is really much more informational. On the other hand, I think the status of experiments is really a little bit closer to the theory, where you can really sort of imagine that some interesting ideas from quantum information and quantum control are really going to have a noticeable and important impact on state-of-the-art technology sort of in the next 3-5 years, something like that. And it's not going to be the sort of thing where we change complexity classes or, you know, change the way that people make security systems. But precision measurement, especially when you're talking about sensors and navigation and things like that, it's a business where if you can make an absolute improvement of a factor of 2 or a factor of 10, it's really important because it kind of qualitatively changes the kinds of things that you can do. And it especially changes, say, how big your pieces of technology need to be. And when you change those kinds of things, it really does change the game. And so you can have a much more profound impact in the near term, I think, by sort of going down in this precision measurement direction in the near term than perhaps one can really do by going up towards the computation and cryptography. Just, you know, sort of talking about near-term practical application. Okay, so most of the slides that I have are actually mostly graphs and equations and stuff like that, a little bit of data. But I wanted to just kind of put in the back of your minds that there's a real experiment there. So this apparatus has gone through several revisions. Early versions of it were mainly the joint work of J.M. Jeremiah, who was a postdoc in our group at the time, and John Stockton, who at the time was a beginning graduate student. After J.M. left, John kind of brought about the second revision of this apparatus. And then since he's left, Tony Miller, who I mentioned on the introductory slide, has been refining things even quite a bit more. It's a fairly typical sort of experiment for atomic physics these days. What you're looking at here, this is just a part of an optical table. These little gray metal boxes are diode lasers. And then what you have down here are just mirrors and lenses and other sorts of optical components that we use to control the steering and the frequency and other things like that, just properties of those laser beams, so that we can bring all of that stuff together and focus everything on the atoms, which are located somewhere in here. So this sort of shiny metal box that you're looking at, that's actually a set of magnetic shielding layers. And so if you were to open up one side of the magnetic shielding box, you could look in and see something like this. And so this thing here is actually, it's a quartz vapor cell. So it's just a sealed glass cell. On the bottom, it's connected to a fairly typical sort of vacuum pumping apparatus, so that what we can do is suck all the normal atmosphere out of there, create a vacuum, and then bleed back in a very dilute gas of room temperature cesium atoms. And cesium is the atom that we like to use, basically just because it's an alkali atom, so its spectroscopy is fairly simple, and people know really quite a lot about how to laser cool cesium atoms and do other sorts of fun things to it. So while the experiment is running, if you actually look into this area with a CCD camera that's sensitive to infrared light, you see an image like this. And so in this picture, you can still see the sort of seams that are the kind of ridges of the walls of the glass cell. And then this white dot in the middle, that's just the scattered laser light from a collection of laser-cooled atoms that are collected in the central part of this chamber. And so for actual dimensions, you know, the size of this ball is something like a few millimeters. And in there, you've got several 10 to the 10 cesium atoms cooled down to a temperature of something like 100 microkelvin. And, you know, the reason why we're using laser cooling in this experiment is actually not anything terribly fundamental. It's mainly just that we would like to work with a collection of atoms where we can just ignore their center of mass motion. So, you know, if we were to talk about cesium atom or just any atoms, let's say, in room temperature in the atmosphere, typical sorts of velocities that they would have are approaching a few hundred meters per second, right? So if they're confined in a glass cell like this, which is, you know, sort of only that far across, you know, they hardly get to travel in a straight line for any time at all before they bump into the walls. And so if you just use a room temperature vapor of atoms, they're constantly bumping into walls and sort of funny stuff is going on that you don't really know how to model, not really. And so by using laser cooling, though, if you get down to temperatures of 100 or 10 or 1 microkelvin, the characteristic velocities are much more like centimeters per second, right? So the atoms are sort of moving like this. And at that velocity, all of the measurements that we want to make can be completed on a timescale of a millisecond or a few milliseconds. So for those sorts of timescales, they're not really going anywhere, right? They're traveling tens of microns or something like that. And so in that limit, we can really just ignore the fact that the atoms move at all. We can just pretend that they're hovering motionless in space. We certainly don't have to worry about how to model things like bumping into the walls of the cell. And also, we intentionally keep the sample sufficiently dilute that we don't have to worry about the atoms ever bumping into one another. And in fact, we don't have to worry about any direct interaction among the atoms at all. So we can ignore things like dipole-dipole interactions or anything like that. So basically, we just end up with a fairly large collection of atoms that are just hanging out there that really respond to laser fields or magnetic fields individually. And we don't have to worry about their interactions, but we have a lot of them. And that's the kind of starting condition we're aiming at.
That we don't have to worry about. Okay. But of course, in reality, there is going to be some tiny probability for, I mean, if you have two atoms, they could hit each other. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, what's the level of those interactions? What error are you making by disregarding them? 10 to the minus?
10 to the minus 7, 8, 9, somewhere in that range. I've never actually sat down to calculate that particular thing, but that would be my sense of it. I mean, certainly, I'll show you that, if I have time, I'll show you in the kind of detailed measurements. We do actually see the effects of, say, the residual motion of the atoms, and we can see that that starts to kick in on a time scale of, say, 3 or 4 milliseconds. Right? We're trying to finish all our business
in a millisecond or so. So that's a thing where we can see where it comes in, so we know that it's negligible where we don't see it. And then things like collisions, I guess we've never taken great pains to really characterize, but I'm quite sure that they're down at that level where we don't worry about them as a dominant sort of systematic effect. Okay, yeah, so that's the last actual picture that I'm going to show. Everything else from now on will be a little bit sort of more conceptual in nature. So what are we doing with these atoms? So we want to make measurements on these things. So after you've kind of frozen out, let's say, the motional degrees of freedom of the atoms by cooling them down, the kinds of dynamics that they have left over are all internal things. So of course, you've got a valence electron, which you can excite to upper states and all that kind of thing, but we actually don't want to do that. We want to leave the electron in its ground its ground state. And so the only sort of dynamical variable that you have left over is the internal spin of the atom. So for a cesium atom in the particular electronic ground state that we choose, the overall spin is 4, right? So it's not a qubit. It's something a little bit more complicated. So it's an F equals 4 thing, which in principle has 9 states that we can access. And the way that we want to make measurements and to manipulate that state, well, the simplest way of actually manipulating that state is by just putting magnetic fields onto the atomic sample, which cause the spins to rotate. I'll get back to that in a second. And then the way that we make measurements is by using a technique called Faraday rotation spectroscopy. So the simple version of the story is that if we have our nice laser-cooled sample of atoms hanging out in the middle of our vacuum cell, we can take a laser probe beam, which is chosen to have the appropriate sort of intensity and frequency, and we prepare that probe beam so that it's linearly polarized when it comes in. And so when that light comes in and interacts with the atoms and then gets transmitted along, the dominant component of the interaction between the atomic internal state and the photon state is that the linear polarization of the probe beam will be rotated by some angle, and that angle should be proportional to the z component of the total spin, that is the kind of added spin of all of those atoms in our sample. So a simple kind of measurement that illustrates the idea is that if we come in with our linearly polarized probe beam, and suppose, what we'll be doing in the experiment is we actually use a process called optical pumping to try to align all of the atomic spins so that they initially point in the x direction, the plus x direction. Right, so nominally, this is an orientation of the spins where the z component is 0. So if we send our probe beam in through the sample under those conditions, we should not observe any rotation of the polarization of the light. But if we now turn on a weak magnetic field in the y direction, right, so the geometry then is that the collective spin vector will start to rotate or precess around the supplied magnetic field, and so it acquires a z component, which is actually oscillating as a function of time, and maybe you know that the frequency of that oscillation, which is called Larmor precession, is proportional to the strength of the applied magnetic field. So a typical piece of data that we might look at, such as this one, so this is actually a single-shot piece of data, which has really not been averaged or anything at all, so this sort of shows you what we look at in real time. So at time 0, we turn on that Y magnetic field to a strength of 27 milligauss. That's not a particularly weak field. It's also not a particularly strong field. For comparison, the magnetic field of the Earth is something like 300 milligauss. So it's about a tenth of the Earth's magnetic field at the surface. And so that's enough to cause the spin vector to precess like this. And so what I'm actually plotting here on this axis is the polarization rotation of the transmitted probe beam. And so as the spins are doing this, at the frequency that you can see, right, then the polarization of the transmitted probe beam is also doing that. And so if we just have a detector up here that can detect the polarization of the light, then it's very easy for us to plot this kind of a trace. Now, if everything were completely ideal, what you would expect to see actually is a sinusoidal oscillation of constant amplitude that should just go on forever. But of course, it's quite clear on this sort of a data trace that there's a decay envelope where something like the effective magnetization of the atoms actually decays fairly strongly as a function of time. And this is basically just, you can just lump it all under the category of decoherence and dephasing. So we happen to know that in the conditions where we took this data, most of this decoherence is actually due to this probeam. Right, so we've taken this data under conditions where our signal to noise is really very high, but where in exchange for that, we actually have a lot of back action from the Faraday rotation probe onto the atomic magnetization, so that a lot of this decay envelope is due to the probeam itself. And even if we were to go away to conditions where the back action were much weaker, you would still see some sort of a decay on the timescale of a few milliseconds, if for no other reason than just that after we turn off the laser cooling stuff, the atoms are subject to gravity. So this little ball of atoms on the timescale of a few milliseconds will start to fall down noticeably just under the influence of gravity. So kind of in the configuration that we have in the experiments, everything really kind of has to be wrapped up by 4 or 5 milliseconds or so. And then whether, you know, things like gravity and other stuff like that, whether that's the dominant source of decoherence or whether the probeam itself is the dominant source of decoherence, that's a trade-off that we can control just by choosing the intensity and the frequency of this probeam accordingly. So now, sort of up to that level of approximation, right? So suppose we really did something where we tried to make the measurement minimally perturbing. You start to get into a regime where it's not ridiculous to call this what a quantum optics person would call a quantum non-demolition measurement. And that's just because if you sort of ignore the little bits of probe-induced decoherence, the form of this measurement is such that the optical polarization of the transmitted light beam should reflect the Z component of the collective atomic spin without really changing it any more than is necessary. Right? So we sort of have a minimal back action for the amount of information that we're gaining. Now, one thing that you have to be sort of careful of is that everybody in our field likes to talk about Faraday rotation as if it were a perfect QND measurement. That is, if this polarization rotation thing were the whole story. But in fact, it's not. If the atom that we were working with happened to actually be a qubit, right, so if its internal state actually happened to be a half, then Faraday rotation really would be the whole story. But basically, because of the fact that the internal spin is higher, when you write down the fundamental QED interaction between light and atoms, what you find is that there are some other components of the interaction which are much more nasty to deal with. And so those get lumped under the heading tensor coupling or tensor interaction. And I'll come back at the end to say how those things complicate our experimental story and the lengths that we have to go to in order to make sure that they don't really corrupt the things we're trying to do.
Be well described by a mixture of a Gaussian and an exponential, or does it have polynomial tails?
You can get into lots of different scenarios. So there are situations in which this is in fact a non-monotonic decay, which would be due to the tensor coupling that you have between the, you know, so if you do this under conditions where the tensor coupling is intentionally made strong, they actually see revivals in the oscillation amplitude. So there are lots of complicated things you can get into. Also, depending on, you know, when the atoms fall down, it can be not just the fact that they're moving out of the laser focus or something like that that's bad. They can come into regions where you have magnetic field gradients that have been canceled out. And so they can introduce really complicated sorts of functional dependencies in the envelope of this decay. But we are typically sort of finishing our measurements on a time scale like this. And if we're careful about what we're doing, we can see that actually it's very, the decay is very linear. So we're really just looking at the beginning of an exponential decay.
David, I presume that you have so many atoms there that you can't see the quantization of the collective spin. So it's just a continuous set of possibilities.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if, in what sense is it quantum non-demolition?
Okay, so I'll get to all that.
Okay.
That's a lot of the story. I wanted in the slide to kind of emphasize the fact that we can make these real-time, let's just call them relatively non-destructive measurements. So we can sort of see what the spins are doing. But I also wanted to emphasize that rather than just letting them do something simple like a Langmuir precession, we can actually exert some degree of control over what they're doing. So in this experiment, remember what we did was to initially optically pump all the spins along the x-axis, and we turn on a weak magnetic field in the y direction, and then we just let them do a free precession. Now, a different sort of thing we can do is pump them in the x direction. Turn on a strong magnetic field along x, so that you sort of adiabatically lock the spins to the direction of the applied field. We can then just, with computer control, vary the field so that it's pointing up or down more or less. That should drag the magnetization vector so that the C component gets larger or smaller, and then that should again be reflected in the rotation of the polarization of the probeam. So this is a figure that John made for his thesis, where you sort of drag things up and down, and if you kind of squint at it, you can see that it actually spells out some words. the whole context of precision measurement in magnetometry, I think this kind of a slide already shows you how you can measure magnetic fields with this type of apparatus, right? Because the frequency of this oscillation is proportional to the strength of the magnetic field, and that constant proportionality is something that one knows very well from atomic physics. So in principle, all you have to do is sort of set up your thing, well, take the sort of an oscillation signal, count the frequency of the oscillation, and that'll tell you what the strength of the applied magnetic field is. Okay. But now suppose that we want to ask, what's the weakest magnetic field we can detect in a given amount of time? Right? I was just saying, we only have really a few milliseconds to work with before everything goes bad. So as you make the field weaker and weaker, of course, this oscillation is going to slow down. So if we go down by about a factor of 10 from 27 milligauss to 2.3 milligauss, we get a slow oscillation like this. And you can see where this is headed, where if you cut this down by, say, another factor of 100, you'll be in a regime where you don't even really get a full oscillation in. You don't get a full cycle in within the observation time that you're allotted. So then what do you do? Again, the problem's really not that bad, because if this is something like sine omega t, and what we're trying to measure is omega, well, if omega t is really small, that just means that you just see the initial linear slope of the thing. Right? So in a limit where you're trying to measure a very weak magnetic field, the kind of signal that you expect to see is actually like this, where rather than trying to count the frequency of the oscillation, really what you're doing is you're trying to measure the slope of this thing. And the slope will contain this information about what the oscillation frequency is sort of going to be, and therefore it gives you information about the strength of the magnetic field. Then where quantum mechanics can come into this, I guess maybe I should talk about this on the next slide. So just remember, this is probably, I can go over this quickly for this audience, I have this large number of cesium atoms that are oriented along the x-axis. Each cesium atom has its own little spin of 4. But since the laser probeam comes in and kind of couples them all in a symmetric way, the variable that you're actually sensitive to, you don't individually resolve the spins of the atoms. Rather, what you tend to do is make a measurement of the sum of them all. So you measure the sort of total angular momentum vector that you get by adding together all of those little spins. And so for a state like this, where they start all pointing in the same direction, that makes, of course, a very long effective spin that lives on this very large effective block sphere. And so even though the length of this thing, which is proportional to the number of atoms, is now going to be something like 10 to the 10, because of the fact that we maintain coherence over the duration of our experiments, you still have to describe this thing as a quantum mechanical quantity. So the Cartesian components of this spin vector now are associated with observables on an Hilbert space, and these don't commute with one another, and they have the same commutation relations as the Pauli matrices. So if you just derive a Heisenberg uncertainty relation among them, you get things that look like this. So for example, the uncertainty in the y component of the vector times the uncertainty in the z component of the vector has to be at least as large as 1/2 the absolute value of the expectation value of x. Right, so plotted on a block sphere like this, that means that even though the sort of coherent part of the vector is really, really very, very long, so it's something like 10 to the 10, you have unavoidable uncertainties in the y and the z directions, which are something like the square root of that. So it'll be something like 10 to the 5. So what these uncertainties mean, then, is that if we sort of think about this plot of what we're expecting to see visualized on the block sphere, it means that in a weak magnetic field, we're causing the magnetization vector to just barely start to tip up towards the north pole. And the thing that you might worry about is that, well, if we have this intrinsic quantum mechanical uncertainty in the values of all these observables to begin with, like this little kind of uncertainty disk on the end of the vector, you might imagine that you would need to allow this thing to rotate so that the total angle became significant compared to the angles attended by this uncertainty law at the end of the stick. And that would be a small angle, right? So in this case, it would be something like 10 to the minus 5. But the interesting thing about this kind of parity rotation spectroscopy is that it actually does not allow you to reach those levels of sensitivity or precision so that you want to start to have to worry about what you're really supposed to do with this quantum mechanical uncertainty. So it's true that even though we're not going to get down to a sort of a projective or discretized level of things, we're sort of in the noise, the uncertainty of the observables, even for a pure state sort of situation. I think I'm going to skip this stuff. Okay, so yeah, so that was sort of, if you asked somebody 5 years ago, let's say, or optimistically, I would say that, you know, before we really did this work, if you were to ask people who were involved in the business of making precision measurements with atoms, what is the story with this intrinsic quantum mechanical uncertainty? Well, that had a name. People would refer to that as the spin projection noise. And it was actually thought that this represented a fundamental quantum mechanical limit to how well you could measure things like a magnetic field using a collection of atoms to get a quantum time. And that was referred to as the spin shot noise limit or the spin projection noise limit. And the story that I want to tell over the next 10 or 15 minutes is a simple little bit of analysis where actually it's fairly easy, you know, in retrospect, it's very easy to convince yourself that if you know what you're doing with your quantum measurements, that's never actually a limitation. And so let me kind of take you through that story the way that we derived it, because I think it shows something interesting about the utility of a control theory perspective and all of this. So how do we want to think about this measurement process sort of working towards a more theoretical sort of representation? So I just gave you kind of the conceptual experimentalist representation. Now let's go to some real equations. So this measurement that we're making, we like to think of it as being pretty much continuous. But in order to model it, you could really do something like the following. So we have this cloud of atoms that's sitting at the center of our vacuum chamber, and we have a coherent state light probe, which is coming through, interacting with the atoms kind of continuously, and then that stream of photons is sort of continuously then going on to a detector where they are destructively detected. But just for the sake of analysis, you can imagine doing something like the following. Take this continuous stream of light and chop it up into a number of sort of virtual pulses. If you don't actually pulse it, but you can do this in the analysis. And so then you would say, well, this first little packet of photons, which we make it a really short slice, probably doesn't need photons in it at all, but it's a very weak pulse of light, just because it's so short, comes and interacts with these atoms in some Hamiltonian sort of way. They become entangled. This little pulse of photons then goes on to the detector and gets detected. Now remember, the thing that we're trying to actually detect with this detector is the angular orientation of the polarization vector. So that's actually a continuous quantity. So if this little first slice of photons only has a few photons in it, you can't do a very good job of nailing down exactly what the polarization angle is. Right? You make a very low signal noise measurement in a short first time slice. So what you get is you get a little bit of information, a little bit of statistical information on the orientation of the polarization, and therefore you get a little bit of statistical information about the orientation of the collective spin vector. But now, in the meantime, the next little pulse of photons has come along, interacted with those same atoms in that same Hamiltonian sort of way. They come to your detector, and basically that next little batch of photons gets you a little bit more statistics on trying to nail down exactly what the rotation angle is, and therefore what the actual orientation of these guys is. So if you think about this picture and kind of translate it into a slightly more textbook representation, this initial state that we make by the optical pumping is what we call a coherent spin state. And since we're trying to talk about measuring the z component of the angular momentum, let's decompose that initial coherent spin state in eigenstates of the z angular momentum operator. So if the eigenvalues of that operator are represented here, and for the sake of illustration, we choose a small number of actual spins, so the sort of discrete states are points along this axis. Maybe the initial coherent spin state is more or less a Gaussian. So before we even start making the measurement, because we know we apply this optical pumping procedure, we can describe the initial spin coherent state as a Gaussian coherent superposition of eigenstates of this angular momentum operator. Now, as sort of some amount of time has gone by, and we've managed to pass some finite number of photons through the atomic sample and to detect them, then we have achieved some statistical resolution on measuring the rotation angle of the polarization, and therefore we have some improved knowledge of exactly what the z component of the angular momentum vector is. And so if you write down the equations that describe that, what they tell you is that this initial fairly wide Gaussian of the coherent state is going to be gradually squished into what we call the spin squeeze state, where really you're just narrowing down that Gaussian as a reflection of the information that you gain from the measurement. And if you were to let this process go on forever, so that you really consider a very large number of photons having interacted with the atoms and come to your detector, so that you really get lots and lots of statistics on exactly what the polarization angle is, then the equations tell you that you would eventually come down to resolving a single eigenstate of the z component of angular momentum. Right? So in this limit, which is the long time limit, this is where you would really get to the eigenstate level and where things would really be discretized. But because we have various sorts of decoherence in this experiment, we're only actually able to access the very initial part of this whole process, that basically on timescales longer than the initial spin squeezing phase, just bad stuff happens, and so you can never actually get down here in an actual experiment. But the way that it begins is, you know, the way that it begins, it's just kind of exactly what you would expect. You start out with a wide Gaussian, and, you know, this uncertainty happens to be coherent uncertainty, if you will, But still, the idea is the same, that you get some information about it. What that leads to is a gradual, is a narrowing of that fit distribution. Now, obviously, because the initial spin state has a variance, if I were to repeat this process over and over again, what I would find is that the actual eigenstate that I end up on in the long time limit is random. And the distribution of which eigenstate I end up with should just reflect the squares of these amplitudes. And what that means in the initial phase is that as this thing starts to narrow down, it's going to start to narrow down around some random offset, which, you know, in some statistical way will eventually become the eigenvalue, if you will. But, you know, so what we observe, what is meant to be happening in these experiments in the early phase is you know that you're going to be narrowing the width of this distribution. You just don't know what center it's going to start to appear towards. Yes?
Is it significant whether you're rotating, while you're doing this measurement, rotating around the z-axis? Does that come in, or is that not necessary?
Oh, so when we're talking about these kinds of measurements, we would try to do these in zero applied mechanical. So the idea is that, especially because of the tensor coupling stuff, you want to not ever really go very far from your initial state. If you do apply magnetic fields, then a similar story holds, but it's a lot more complicated.
Okay, so this there is no amplitude.
In this story here, there's no drift amplitude. There's only the interaction amplitude of the measurement.
Did
you
put a spin
center
this
M? Or?
No.
Oh, that. So that's a parameter that measures that characterizes the strength of the measurement.
How does this scale with the number of atoms that you actually have?
The thing that you scale with fundamentally is a product of the intensity of the light and the optical density. So what matters is the kind of number of atoms that you have stacked up and all along the line. And it doesn't actually directly depend on the number. So the measurement strength doesn't actually depend directly on the number of atoms. So what are the equations? So you can actually describe this process by equations that you can derive pretty much from first principle. So if you just start from QED, you write down the interaction between the photons and the atoms, and then you make a bunch of approximations which are controlled approximations, you can eventually get yourself to what a quantum optician would call the stochastic master equation that describes this process, or in fact, it was first derived by people working in mathematical physics, by people like Balakhin. And in that community, it's known as the quantum filtering equation. And so our group has done a little bit of work in trying to kind of draw the parallels between the way that we think about stochastic master equations for control in AMO physics and the way that the mathematical physics people like to talk about these things just from a sort of abstract point of view. So here is the stochastic master equation for our system in a form that was first derived by Howard Weissman and colleagues. And it's like a master equation. Many of you, I'm sure, have seen these things. So rho here is the density matrix of all of the atomic spins. And it's the full many-body density matrix. So it's not a reduced one spin operator or anything like that. So the differential of that thing, so the way it changes in each time step, it's got a piece which is the Schrödinger equation. So here we are allowing for a signal field along the y-axis, although it's assumed to be small, because eventually we want to use this equation to show ourselves how we measure the strength of that applied magnetic field. So this is the sort of drift Hamiltonian, if you will. This piece here is some dissipation, the decoherence induced by the measurement. And then what you have here is the sort of interesting part that makes it stochastic. Y of t is actually the photocurrent that it's the signal that your detector, your photodetectors are giving you. Right? So on shot to shot, this is a different random realization of some stochastic process, which is literally just it's the signal that comes out of here. And so this expected FC, the units here are such that this term here is actually the expectation value of the signal lineage time step. And so what appears here inside the parentheses is the difference between the actual observation at a given time step and the expected observation in that time step, given the conditional state of the previous time step. Okay. So that structure that's present in this equation is a thing that ties it very much to nonlinear control theory, because a stochastic control theory person would say that, oh, this process is the innovations process, and the form that you see here makes this thing a Kushner-Schrödinger equation. And in fact, that's true, that you know, if you just write this thing down in some universal mathematical form and show it to a control theorist, they'll recognize it as a Kushner-Schrödinger filtering equation. Now, the algebraic form of this equation is not so complicated. It's a fairly nice one. However, the dimension of the density matrix is in principle very large. Remember, if small f is the spin in each cesium atom, that's 4. And if the number of atoms that we're talking about in practice is somewhere between 10 to the 8 and 10 to the 9, depending on what we want to optimize, well, this is 9 to the 10 to the 10, let's say. Right? So it's a ridiculous dimension. Now, of course, there's a symmetry that you can make use of, right? So the idea that initially we try to prepare all of the spins pointing in the same direction, and then the interaction of the probeam with those atoms is symmetric. That means that you actually retain, you start out with and you retain a complete permutation symmetry that one of the spins in the ensemble.
Which is kind of the thing, same thing as saying that when we add all of these spins together, we only care about the sort of largest block sphere on the outside, and we don't have to worry about the other smaller angular momentum representations, just because we've sort of kept ourselves in that largest permutation symmetry. And so that means that you can immediately drop down the size of this thing that you care about to 2f times n. But that's still pretty big. This is now 8 times 10 to the 10. So the thing that eventually saves us at the end of the day and allows us to do some analysis is the fact that, well, I had mentioned that this initial coherent spin state looks like the Gaussian on the sort of surface of the block sphere, sort of. And then since we only ever start to access little bits of spin squeezing, right, we don't get very deep into the quantized, discretized regime because decoherence prevents us from going there. It means that if we try to visualize our state somehow on the surface of the block sphere, it's always more or less a Gaussian. So if your state has a representation that's more or less Gaussian, well, all you really need to do is keep track of its centroid and its covariance matrix, and those are sufficient statistics. So in fact, the way that we really get somewhere in the analysis of this system is to take this equation and just to project onto first and second moments of the operators that we care about, and that immediately just brings us down to a set of a few equations, and those are informationally complete up to the Gaussian approximation. So when you do that, you get this equation. And this, now, you don't even have to go to a professional control theorist with this equation. I claim that if you take somebody who went through my first year controls class in graduate school for mechanical engineering, they will recognize this thing as a Kalman filter. At least if they got an A in the class, they'll recognize it as a Kalman filter. And so what you have is you have a kind of a, there's actually a deterministic equation here for the evolution of the uncertainty in the Z component of the angular momentum. And it just says that in a given amount of time, you know you're going to get a certain rate of photons coming into your detector, so you get a certain amount of information, which means that your uncertainty on the spin state has decreased by a given amount. But remember I was saying that the spin squeezing Gaussian sort of localizes around an unpredictable point, and so that randomness comes in here, where dW now is that innovations process, which is the difference between the actual photocurrent and the predicted photocurrent, and so this is an equation which randomly sort of drives the centroid of that Gaussian somewhere. So one of the things you can do with this equation is you can simulate it. So you can sort of do self-consistent simulations of this model. And here are the results of some very simple simulations. Now what's plotted up here on the top, this is the actual signal that you would see in the experiment. Doesn't look very interesting. Down here are, if this thing is y of t, so if you take that photocurrent and plug it in as the driving term to this stochastic differential equation, and then just integrate the thing, right? This dark blue line is showing you the driven evolution of the expectation value of the angular momentum, and the light blue shaded region around it is indicating the plus or minus one standard deviation. So it's showing the uncertainty in f sub z. So what you see in the simulations of the equations, where again the time down here is in natural units of the measurement strength, is that indeed, the uncertainty that you have in the z value of the angular momentum is decreasing in some deterministic way. But now the expectation value of it kind of diffuses around for a while, but then eventually sort of settles down. And so this here is the spin squeezing process viewed in our control theoretic sort of terms. And the idea, again, is that if I were to repeat the simulation over and over again, what I would find is that the dark blue line would choose a different sort of point to settle down on. And if I were to extrapolate this out to infinite time, I would end up sitting on some allowed discrete eigenvalue of the f sub z operator. But at the early stage of the game, all you really know with a finite amount of data is sort of what, you know, generally where is it starting to localize. So what about this data? Well, sort of the neat thing about this analysis is that, remember, this version of the Kalman filter came from our fancy Bolovkin filtering equation, which came from quantum field theory, et cetera. On the other hand, this is a sensible equation for a classical control theorist. So we can ask, well, when the classical control theorist looks at this equation, where does he or she think that they came from? They would say that, well, okay, this is the Kalman filter for the following situation. There's a random number, and I don't know that random number, but it has a Gaussian distribution around zero. So imagine the little gnome in the lab just generates that random number, and the signal that that little lab gnome starts to give you is a constant value, which is proportional to that random number, but plus Gaussian white noise, stationary Gaussian white noise. Right, so the signal that you would get is something like this, and the idea is that this stationary Gaussian white noise This is the optical shot noise of the measurement that you're making with your probe beam. But then what you really care about in your measurement is you want to know what's the constant value that sits underneath it. Right, so if you look at the simulated data trace, you can see that the mean value of this thing is not zero. It's something positive. So the game is, as the experimentalist, you're given data that looks like this, and your job is to try to understand what is the DC offset underneath the zero mean Gaussian noise process. Now, obviously, if I only give you a little bit of this data, you can't do a very good job, because any sort of averaging you might try to do will still be left with a lot of kind of corruption from the noise. But as I give you more and more of this signal, where the constant offset is always the same, you do a better and better job of filtering down these Gaussian fluctuations. And if I give you an infinite amount of data like this, you can do an arbitrarily good job of nailing down what the offset is. And that's exactly the game that you're playing here, which is to say that, well, when we're trying to do something like magnetometry or measuring the Z component of the spin of all these things, the way that you're allowed to think of it is that the eigenvalue that you're going to end up with already exists in some objective sense. It's a random number that you just don't happen to know, right? And if you're worried about that from a quantum mechanical point of view, the reason why we get away with that is because we're only ever caring about one observable, right? We never ask anything about the non-commuting observables, therefore we don't have to worry about quantum mechanics. So from the statistical inference point of view, as a precision measurement person, we can just pretend that this whole problem is really classical. There's an unknown value that pre-exists. It is given to us in the measurement signal, but buried under some zero mean Gaussian noise, and our job is just to figure out what is that offset. Yes?
Dynamics that commute with the observable, mm-hmm. then that would violate that statement.
Yep.
You'd have to do something more complex.
Right, and things would become much more interesting. And I want to get back to that. But for now, let's just put in a little bit of noise that commutes with the thing that we care about, namely, what happens if we have a small dynamic? So things will still more or less commute. So kind of, you know, a way that you can understand this piece of this piece of simulated data.
This is like the signal that you would get in a magnetometry experiment when you really had zero magnetic field. Now, what happens if you do have a magnetic field? Well, we actually already looked at an example of it. Let me not try to page back there. But remember when I was talking about the oscillating signal and sort of decreasing the magnetic field and just talking about that inertial slope? Right, so if you do have a magnetic field present, this is the kind of thing that you would be looking at. Where again, this is an artist's rendition of the data, of the data thing. And so what this whole analysis says is that how should I analyze this data? Well, I get this sort of linearly sloped, kind of noisy looking thing. So that's the actual data that comes out of my experiment. And all I have to do now is fit a straight line to the data. When I do that, the slope of the line that I get out of the fit has all the information that I want about my estimate of the magnetic field. Right? Because it's just kind of showing me how this thing is rotating. And now the offset that I get here, that's the quantum mechanical randomness. Right? So if I were to repeat this kind of a measurement over and over again, always with exactly the same magnetic field and everything else the same, then what I should expect is that on every shot of the experiment, I should observe a line with the same slope, but with a randomly generated offset. And the statistics of this randomly generated offset are going to be a Gaussian corresponding to the uncertainty of my initial spin coherent state. And so if my goal is to estimate magnetic fields without being confused by quantum noise issues, all I have to do is analyze my data in this way, keep the slope as my estimate of the magnetic field, and throw away the intercept, because that's just some random number that quantum mechanics is giving me. Now, the cute thing about this is that, you know, if you sort of show this to a person who is from the precision measurement community, well, they would normally not make a magnetometer this way, right? And in fact, let me just mention that if I take this diagram for the magnetometry and flip it on its side, that's the diagram for an atomic clock. So they would normally use a thing called the Ramsey method of time-separated oscillatory fields or something like that. But the upshot of it is it just corresponds to just making an accurate measurement of a single point at the end. Right, so if the only data that I give you is the end point of this line, note that you are not able to separate out the slope contribution from the offset contribution, right? Because they get added together in some inseparable way. What I'll have is the slope times the observation time plus the intercept. And if that's the only thing I have, so if I just make a single measurement at the end, that's the best I can do. I will always be my accuracy will always be compromised by this quantum uncertainty. However, if I make a continuous measurement like this, or let's say if I at least make two measurements along this line using a non-demolition kind of technique, then I can always play this game of separating out the slope of that line, which is the information I want, from the intercept, which is the quantum noise, and I never have to worry about the quantum noise. Now, one more cute little thing that I want to mention, because it has, again, to do with control theory. So the one problem in this story that a good experimentalist will bring up right away is, well, think about what you're doing. So we have a magnetization vector, and it's rotating, and the angular velocity is set by the strength of the magnetic field. That's what we're trying to measure. Now, the thing that our Faraday rotation spectroscopy gives us is the z component of this vector as a function of time. Right, so I see this. Now, if I want to go from the z component to the angle, I have to divide by the length of the vector. And the length of the vector is proportional to the number of atoms that I'm using in the experiment. So this points out that if I want to do this extremely accurately, I actually have to know the number of atoms that I'm using extremely well. And that turns out to be exceedingly difficult to do. But a thing that saves you at the end of the day is you can just use a little bit of very simple feedback control. And so, again, this is now an analysis using our Kalman filter that a first-year graduate student in control theory could do. It just says that as you observe this signal, so you start to see that the vector is tipping up, you don't let it tip up. So what you do is when you notice that starting to happen, in the experiment, you turn on a magnetic field that tries to rotate it back down. And you do this in a real-time feedback kind of way so that what your the goal of your feedback loop is to actually keep the magnetization vector locked to a zero z component. Right, so if you think about it, you can figure out what that zero condition is without knowing the length of the vector at all. And then if you're able to achieve this in the experiment, you can just say, well, what magnetic field did I have to apply, what compensation field did I have to apply in order to prevent the magnetization vector from rotating? Well, and that's going to be exactly equal and opposite to the signal field that was originally present, which was the thing that you were trying to measure. And so even with all the feedback control and all that stuff, you can do a very simple analysis which shows you that when you do things in this way, you become very highly immune to uncertainties in the actual numbers of atoms while retaining the ability to go below the so-called spin projection noise limit. So several years ago now, we actually did an experiment where we demonstrated this basic principle. So we showed that you could measure magnetic fields in this feedback kind of way, and that this works not only for constant magnetic fields, but also for magnetic fields that have some time variation. And we wrote that up and published it, but the thing that was really not so satisfying about this work was in the way that we were doing things back then, we really did not have a very good ability to understand what was the actual number of atoms that we were using. And corresponding to that, even though we were able to make fairly precise measurements, we didn't really know where to kind of draw the line of where the interesting spin projection noise limit was. And at the time, back in 2004, when we were doing that work, we thought it would be just a matter of a few more months of figuring out how to do that. But basically, we're still working on that. And it turns out to be a really difficult thing to do. So in terms of proportioning the time, I want to kind of flash through the technical details of what we've been doing for the past few years in terms of what are the difficulties in really, so I think from a fundamental physics point of view, from say like the National Science Foundation's point of view, I would say we've already done this interesting work of really illustrating how it is that you connect sort of abstract ideas of quantum noise and measurement to a detailed physical model like Faraday rotation and atoms and things like that. But from the precision measurement point of view and the point of view of applications, what we really, really need to do is an experiment where with full confidence we know exactly where the spin projection noise limit is in terms of how sensitive how small a magnetic field we're able to measure, and then to definitively demonstrate that we go below that using our technique. And so the two components of that are difficult are, first of all, getting down to that level of sensitivity. There are lots of systematic issues that you have to strongly suppress in order to get down to this spin projection noise limit. And then, as I was just alluding to, you have to know exactly where that spin projection noise limit is, which is to say you have to know exactly how many atoms you're using. And both of those things turn out to be hard. There's sort of one dominant thing which makes it difficult to get down to that level of precision, and it's this thing that I mentioned a long time ago at the beginning of the talk, where because of the fact that we're using an F equals 4 ground state and an F equals 5 excited state, so this is not a qubit to qubit kind of transition, then Faraday rotation is not the only aspect of the interaction between the photons and the atoms, but actually have this complicated tensor interaction thing that comes in. And so that tensor interaction does bad stuff. In particular, it does things where, like, even though, where the Faraday rotation is concerned, if your atoms are pointing in some direction and now you turn on your probe beam and start to send it through, the Faraday rotation should give you a readout of what the direction of those spins is, but it shouldn't kick them around. Whereas if you now start to acknowledge the fact that the tensor coupling is there, what you find out is that there is a single condition you could use, namely if the polarization vector of the input light is exactly aligned with the initial orientation of the spins, then there is no perturbation associated with the tensor coupling. But if your optical polarization comes in just a little bit off, you find that when you turn the light on, it actually gives the atomic spin vector a little bit of a kick, which then has some sort of transient dynamics that you have to deal with. And so one of the things that we've had to work very hard on is figuring out how to get control over the polarization direction and, in fact, just the propagation direction of the light really make sure that we can achieve that alignment. And so sort of at the time where we published our first paper on this stuff, you know, some relevant variance in how well we can control those angles is something like 10 to the minus 4, whereas now we've beat that down to 10 to the minus 9. So we've got 5 orders of magnitude improvement in variance over how well those things are controlled, and there's like a long list of technical things that you have to do to do that. So one of the things that's really important that allows us to do is it allows us to do this whole experiment closer to the resonance of the ground to excited state transition. And that's an important thing for lots of reasons. It allows us to achieve a higher effective measurement strength, which we wouldn't be able to do that without these technical improvements on the polarization and such. We've developed a number of somewhat novel spectroscopic techniques for being able to determine exactly what the optical depth of our McNeagle optical trap is, and also what the degree of polarization is that we achieve by our initial optical pumping. And then we can sort of, with these tools, we can check in two independent ways whether we know those parameters well. And on good days, we observe that those things are within 10% of each other, which I think is really very encouraging. We also have some details like, well, okay, so I mentioned earlier on that the figure of merit for your measurement is the kind of integrated optical density when you cut a line through the trap. One of the things that tells you is that if you collected a trap of atoms, which is more or less round, you should actually try to only use the little central bit of it, right? Because if I go through the edge of the sphere, I don't have that many atoms along a line, whereas if I go through the center of it, I have a lot more. So in fact, I win if I focus down my beam so that the optical probe actually ignores all the atoms out on the wings, but then goes through the deepest, densest part of the trap just right in the middle. That's fairly easy to do, but it brings up the complication now that I've got a Gaussian laser beam, which is now propagating through this trap. And so, in fact, not all of the atoms that I'm coupling to see the same intensity. So I've actually messed up a little bit this permutation symmetry that I tried to invoke before. But luckily, it turns out you can sort of do a whole long huge. So Andrew Silberfarb, Luke Bounton, and I forgot to mention Orion Christofoli, they spent many months trying to deal with this and involved a whole, well, it involved a really brute force kind of overkill kind of calculation using quantum stochastic differential equations of 3D optical modes, all this stuff. It basically allows you to confirm a fairly simple model for how you should deal with that, which is just that you need to sort of, your effective atom number looks like you kind of take every atom, multiply it by the relative intensity of the light beam at its position, and then add them all up like that, and that gives you an effective atom number, which is a bit of a surprise because from previous work that I had done in cavity QED, I would have thought that you'd want to weight locally by the square root of the intensity, whereas it turns out that you weight by the intensity. One of the ways that we can check that we really understand that whole business is that if you just look at something like, I take my atoms, I point them all up, and now I turn on my Faraday rotation measurement, I should just now get a measure of how many atoms there are, but then the probe-induced decoherence should start to make that magnetization decay. And so getting the slope of that initial decay correct in modeling is very sensitive to the details of all this transverse stuff. And so here are some plots at different optical powers of showing you that the blue data agrees with the magenta theoretical prediction really very well. And so that gives us good confidence that we understand all of that stuff. And then as I was sort of mentioning earlier, if you look out at longer time scales of 5-10 milliseconds, you start to see the blue and the red curves deviate from one another. And we understand that as being residual effects of the atomic motion. So we feel we've got a very good handle on all of that stuff. And the sort of the tentative preliminary result thing, these are some plots that I want to skip the details of in order to mention my connection to more abstract stuff in just the last couple of minutes. But basically what they show is that if we make our measurements sort of without the atoms being there, we observe that the actual signal is really just limited by the optical shot noise, just our estimate of a zero, so we apply zero magnetic field, and we see how well we can measure that zero magnetic field by the method that I've been describing. And so we showed that when the atoms aren't there, everything averages down so that the rate at which we gain statistical confidence about the zero is just limited by the optical shot noise. That's really good. And then when we add the atoms in there and we try to measure the magnetic field, we start to limit into some value, which is what which is pretty much exactly what we think it should be, given all of these independent calibrations. And so these are plots that, you know, we were already making back in 2004, 2005. What I would say is that in those plots back then, we really didn't know what we were talking about when we put sort of interesting limit lines in there. Whereas now, as the product of another 3 or 4 years of work, we sort of really do understand where those limit lines are supposed to go. And I don't want to say too much because this is really preliminary, but it looks like we really are right in the right ballpark to hopefully very soon make a definitive demonstration of going below the spin projection noise limit. I think the main difficulty in that is just going to be the fact that the experiments have to pick up and move from Caltech to Stanford towards the end of November. So just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to kind of mention something which is more related to stuff that I guess people have been talking about here this week. I mentioned at some point this idea that, well, in magnetometry, the actual inference problem that we're doing is actually rather classical because we only ever care about one observable. Right? We're only measuring the z component of the angular momentum. Even if we have a magnetic field present which starts to move the field vector, right, if the rotation is small compared to the curvature of the sphere, right, we're pretty much still just talking about changes in z, and we never really wrap that over into any other observable. And so the whole problem is really kind of classical. But now, as soon as you start really saying that we want to measure rotations around more than one axis at the same time, well, then we're going to start necessarily bringing in several observables that don't commute with one another, and our measurement problem is going to become really a lot more quantum mechanical. And so one context in which you can do that, which is very closely related to our experiment, is that, you know, we assume that we know that the magnetic field is along the geometric y-axis. So we have and we just want to know its magnitude. So we have a scalar magnetometry problem. On the other hand, you could ask, well, what if I want to measure a magnetic field and I don't know its direction either? So that would be a vector magnetometry problem. And there's a very nice analysis of that by Klaus Mohmer's group from back in 2005. And there's a funny tie back to that in just a second. So if we were to take our experiment and try to, say, follow a Clausius procedure for trying to measure a vector magnetic field, then we're really getting into a business where the whole thing is much more quantum mechanical because there are multiple non-commuting observables that we now want to know about. But from a more abstract point of view, we get to tie to this neat stuff about reference frames and covariant measurements, which I know several people here are real experts in. But in case any of you haven't heard about it, this goes back to this neat observation by Gizan and Popescu of 8 years ago. So suppose what I want to do is I have a communication scenario, but I'm not trying to send you abstract information. I'm actually trying to indicate to you a direction in physical space. Okay, so I want to point in this direction. But the only resource that I have for the communication is that I get to send you 2 qubits. So you might think that the best thing to do would be to just take your 2 qubits, literally point them in that direction that you mean, and then send them off to the other person. And the other person would have to make some measurements to try to then recover that orientation, which would then be the sort of decoding of that information of a physical direction in space. Well, it turns out that if you're given 2 qubits, you can show in very definite terms that if I take my 2 qubits, align one in the direction that I care about, and then anti-align the other, that's actually better. Now, it's easy to see why that should be, basically just that, you know, what am I really trying to do? Well, I'm trying to communicate in a rigid body rotation between, well, in almost a rigid body rotation, between my reference frame and your reference frame. And so really what I ought to be asking about are how does this state kind of transform under arbitrary rotations? And so if I choose this thing which is permutation symmetric, well, I know that I'm only ever going to sort of fill out 3 out of the 4 dimensions in the joint Hilbert space. And so it's sort of not filling the volume in an efficient way. Whereas if I think about this guy, this is a coherent superposition of the singlet zero and the triplet zero. So it actually spans across 2 different representations of the rotation group. So in principle, if I take this sort of state and now apply rotations to it, I can get to the full four-dimensional Hilbert space rather than just the 3-dimensional subspace. So when a measurement is made on the other end, there's a little bit more information that is in principle available. And so I'm glossing over some details and getting others wrong, but that's the basic idea. So if I want to generalize that to the idea of N spins, well, there's this very nice work. Several groups have been involved in it. I've always liked the treatment that comes out of Dariano's group. And so this says something like, if I've got n spins and I want to indicate a direction in space, well, there's an optimal state that you can derive and an optimal measurement that you can derive for doing that. But much like the two-spin case, that sort of operational thing that an experimentalist immediately ties onto is that the optimal states are no longer permutation symmetric, right? And in principle, you start having to use coherent superpositions of states that come from different irreps of the rotation group. And so unlike the way that we make our little spin squeeze states from the experiment that I talked about before, it's much less clear how you should try to make those things in the laboratory. And in particular, there's a particular kind of funny optimal distribution over the different IRREPs that you're supposed to try to achieve in order to do these problems optimally. So one of the very nice things that Andrew Silberfarb has been doing in our group, in collaboration with Klaus Molmer and also with some other people in our group, is to show that there's a very simple procedure by which you can very closely approximate the optimal states for making this kind of thing. And the simple thing you have to do is take your set of atoms and split it in half. And so now if we just use the same kinds of tools that I've already been talking about, where I can act either independently on the two halves of the ensemble or jointly on the two, then that's now enough freedom where I can mix up the permutation symmetry enough to very closely approximate the optimal states that have been derived abstractly, and in fact to approach the same kind of scaling in terms of the efficiency with which you can do this this pointing estimation problem as a function of the number of atoms. And to get all the way back to talking about sort of precision measurement tasks that an experimentalist cares about, well, in the experiment that I would envision, I'm not going to try to send a direction to anybody else, right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to indicate a direction in space by choosing the right initial state of my spins, and I'm just trying to send that to myself, right? And this is otherwise known as a gyroscope, right? Because the idea is I take my spins, I align them in some known direction at time t equals zero, and the kind of play scenario is imagine that's on a satellite. Now the satellite gets hit by some piece of dust. The satellite rotates for a while before it can slow down, but the spins have just been floating there, pointing in the same direction. And now in my reoriented lab frame, I want to remeasure what that direction was so that I can get my bearing straight again and restore my trajectory. So a gyroscope is actually just a sort of in situ or in place version of this direction communication problem. And so I think it'll be a very interesting challenge for the experimental community that after we kind of finish dotting the I's and crossing the T's on things like magnetometers and clocks, to think about generalizing to these higher dimensional kind of estimation problems, where I think we really will start to make contact with some of these neat general ideas about optimal covariant measurements for all kinds of different symmetry groups. Okay, thanks very much for your patience.
Talked about projections, spin projection, uncertainty. I forget the exact word.
Yeah.
I guess you're just getting down to it now. In principle, the way you're reading it, I guess, is to sort of, I mean, it came from the uncertainty relation between the, what is it, x and y, or let's say x and y. And so you're squeezing it down in one direction, that means it's spreading out in the other direction. So in principle, there's a, it seems to me there might be a genuine quantum limit there because you can only squeeze it by 2 pi or pi or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I guess that's
yeah.
Many orders of magnitude.
Yeah, that's way down there.
So, is there any help I've ever seen? Something like that.
Sure. So, that's the thing where the smaller number, so the fewer atoms you use, the more visible that limit becomes. And so, there certainly are ways that you can approach that complex that can be 3D. So if you use a high-finesse optical resonator to improve the sensitivity of your measurement, I think people have been saying you ought to be able to do these kinds of measurements with, say, 100 atoms. And so there, you really could get to that limit, which is actually known as the Heisenberg limit in spin resonance, where there is that optimal degree of squeezing. It's, you know, kind of what it is just you need both a small uncertainty here, but you need a long length of the vector because you're trying to measure an angle like this. Now, as you squeeze, the squeezing thing comes around the circle, and if you think about it, then when you average over that uncertainty, you actually start to shorten the vector. So you start to lose some of the coherent part of your measurement, and so the optimal trade-off between those two things is what's called the Heisenberg limit. And in this kind of a context, you've got n spins, right? So you might think that the best resolution that you could get in the measurement would scale exponentially with n, right, because the size of the Hilbert spin does. But it turns out that the standard way of doing these things, the variance scales with 1 over the square root of n, this limit, known as the Heisenberg limit, is a 1 over n precision limit. So that's, you know, achieving that kind of Heisenberg limit, the sensitivity is sort of the ultimate quantum limit for these calculations.
Yeah, I was wondering about how close you can get to the optimal distribution in the sense of what is the new scaling. In the context of phase estimation, you have a similar problem. Nobody knows how to prepare the optimal state, which would get you the true 1 over n scaling. But there is some work that I'm thinking, by a paper by a colleague,
ratios you can get, instead of 1 over n, you get log n over n, which is close to the optimal. So I'm wondering if really what you get here is something like log n over n squared, as opposed to really 1 over n squared.
That's possible. I mean, I think the only way that we've been, that Andrew has been able to establish the scaling is numerically for not huge numbers of spins. I don't know the details of what accuracy he thinks they call the scaling, but that's something that we could ask him about. And you can kind of say, man, I think this is literally true. So that little glitch on the end, in the distribution of the different theorems, as opposed to the smooth thing you're supposed to get there. I mean, I think that kind of, those two shapes are obviously not the same. But the claim is that they're not that different, but just to numerical accuracy, you observe this 1 over n squared scaling.
Right. So, I was wondering about your statement that the most difficult part is determining the number of atoms that are in the apparatus. But don't you get that from the variation of the signal with the intensity of the electromagnetic field that passes, that in some simple way is proportional to the number of atoms that you can have with the electromagnetic field?
So what you get directly is a measure of the density of atoms. Right, so if you look at that kind of variation, what you get is a measure of the two dimensions, the density of atoms across the sample. Now, in order to convert that to the actual number, then you need to understand exactly what is the spatial profile of the beam that you're using, so that you can multiply those two things together to get a number. But then also you have to understand how to scale the effect of that number with the non-uniform profile of the protein. And so in the end, it's not such a difficult thing to do. I mean, once you know the answer, it's easy to apply. But we had to do some things like derive the fact that the weighting in the effective atom number calculation is by the local intensity, which is a little bit of a surprise. And then we just had to develop ways of making sure that we really were accurate in the way we determine not only the density, but also you have to know the effective degree of polarization at the initial state. So sort of, it's almost straightforward.
So you mentioned here the experimental problem of preparing optimal states. Have you thought at all about the problem of doing the optimal measurements?
So Andrew actually has a way which is very similar to, if most of your state preparation is done by this conditional kind of stuff, then measuring is preparing a first one. And so it relies on kind of a funny thing where when you've got a large number of atoms, you can do a weak measurement to try to orient all so that you almost know what the final spin state is. You sort of get to the right rotation of your state preparation thing. And you can do that with a small amount of back action when you have a large number of atoms. And then once you get sort of like roughly gotten what the rotation is, you get the sort of fine-grained information by essentially repeating your preparation procedure, which was a conditional thing.
One last question?
Yeah, so you pointed out that this, in principle, could produce something like a gyroscope. So there are experiments, of course, with precision gyroscopes that are very useful, then, especially experiments for measuring precessions, general relativistic precessions, and so on. So do you have any idea how this compares to the ones that are available now, so potentially?
So I should qualify all this by saying that I myself am not really a precision measurement person. I get scared by real precision measurement stuff. But there are certain applications like, actually, and magnetometry is not one of them. I'm not sure exactly where gyroscopes are going to be, but for making accelerometers, technology using atoms like this are actually the best performing technologies available. And the kinds of performance improvements that you can imagine by this kind of technique are sort of a factor of 10 or maybe 2 factors of 10, somewhere in there. Now, when we start talking about gyroscopes, I would never claim that this kind of procedure is going to compete with STEP or some really serious experiment like that. More where you can see the short-term technology impact of these things is that if you can get away with getting the same, if you get better accuracy with a fixed number of atoms, that's the same thing as getting the same accuracy with fewer atoms. Right? And so a lot of the envisioned practical impact is that by these techniques, you should be able to make smaller instruments that achieve an interesting level of precision. And so they will say things like, if you can take an apparatus that's a meter and shrink it down to 10 centimeter size, that completely changes the kind of application for which we use them. Because then you can put them in little robot vehicles and whatever, and send them down into caves and things like that.
Okay. Well, anyway.
is around for, is that the rest of the day?
Yeah, tomorrow morning.
Okay, in room 351 and says. So let me ask you to all join with me in thinking of everything for this morning.